Happy October, everybody. I can honestly say this is the first time in years that October has actually felt like what it looks like on TV. It's beautiful outside. And we're going to get started with this month's episode of AZMcast. This month, we're doing cardiac stuff. We've got some great stuff. We've got Jared Mosier talking about heart failure. This was a request from Steve Grokey. So, Grokey, I hope you have this as your ringtone for the next month. Mosier's also going to do his trolling the web segment where he talks about some emerging studies that are asking us as emergency doctors to try to predict the outcome of patients that get return of spontaneous circulation in the ED. Interesting stuff, and a little bit more than I'd like on my shoulders right now. Finally, we're going to end up with some low-risk chest pain interviews. Your favorite topic and mine, low-risk chest pain, and we're asking several of the attendings, what would you do with a low-risk chest pain patient? The results may surprise you.
I'm gonna pop some tags. Only got $20 in my pocket. I'm looking for a come up. This is trolling the web.
There's a fair amount of discussion on the blogosphere about prognostication for out-of-hospital cardiac arrest. And I just wanted to comment on that. So if somebody comes in with an out-of-hospital cardiac arrest and you get spontaneous circulation back, and they have no cough, no gag, and their pupils are fixed and dilated, and if you determine that that patient's brain dead and you tell the family they're brain dead, there's no chance of survival, you'll be wrong about 30% of the time. And that 30% of the time, they'll walk out of the hospital, or at least be discharged from the hospital. So that's led to, how long do we have to wait before we can reliably say that this patient is brain dead or doesn't really have a chance of meaningful survival? It turns out that the neurologic studies say that that's about 72 hours, so day three. But one of the issues that we do to add a wrinkle to that is we put people on hypothermia if they're comatose. So if you think about hypothermia, that really prolongs that 72-hour period until they're off hypothermia and rewarmed, and then you start the 72-hour clock. So what I typically do is tell the family, look, right now they are comatose. We treat those patients by cooling them down, and then once we warm them up, we have to wait 72 hours to reliably say what their neurologic outcome is going to be. And in this fashion, you go from telling them they're probably going to be brain dead to this is going to be a long, agonizing 5 to 6 days before we can really give you any reliable information as to their recovery. So that's about it for spending the web. Not much else is going on. Let us know if you have any other questions.
That actually makes me feel better. I like the fact that I'm not good at predicting who's going to have a good outcome and who's not from the emergency department. So I think the way this helps us is to be a little bit vague, but to prepare the family that this is going to be a process. So thanks, Jared. Jared's next going to talk about heart failure. But first, I'd like you all to just take a moment and be thankful that I have not gone crazy with the heart puns like I wanted to. I promise you, there will be absolutely no Demi Lovato. No Billy Ray Cyrus. But maybe just a little bit of Toni Braxton. She just speaks to you, doesn't she?
There are basically several different types of heart failure. And I like to think about things as left heart failure or right heart failure. The reason is that the left heart is a high pressure pump system. And it's a high pressure pump system because it has to overcome the arterial pressure system. The right heart is a low pressure system. It's a high compliance system. And the reason is that the pulmonary circulation isn't a high pressure system, so the right heart doesn't have to generate high pressures to eject blood into the vascular system. So when you're looking at right heart failure, you have to ask yourself, is it from an RV infarct where the muscle is damaged, or is it from a pulmonary embolism where the pressure that the RV has to overcome is too high? Both of those eventually lead to the same outcome, but are treated a little bit differently. So the right ventricle is able to maintain coronary blood flow for longer than the left heart. The reason is because the chamber pressures are lower, you don't have occlusion of the vascular system for that chamber, and you're able to maintain coronary perfusion. So if you have somebody who has an inferior MI, they may or may not show RV dysfunction on an echo until way late. But if you have somebody who has RV pressure overload from, let's say, a pulmonary embolism. Let's say they have a pulmonary embolism and their RV pressure is really high because their PA pressure is high. That pressure overloaded right heart isn't able to really eject enough stroke volume to the pulmonary circulation. However, systemically, the left heart is able to maintain its stroke volume because of interventricular dependence, meaning that as the right heart contracts, the septum bows into the left ventricle. The free wall of the left ventricle is able to maintain its filling, but it's limited by the pericardium. So when the left ventricle contracts and you have that bowing of the septum in systole, it's able to eject a stroke volume. But what happens if you give that patient a bunch of fluid, you're going to volume overload that right heart, and it's going to push the septum into the left ventricle during diastole, and the left heart isn't going to be able to maintain cardiac output, and you're going to have more cardiovascular collapse. So really a massive pulmonary embolism or submassive pulmonary embolism that's causing shock is one of only a couple of types of heart failure, one of only a couple of types of shock that you can make worse with giving fluids. So be cautious of that. And whether it's a PE or an RV infarct, you really want to try to keep from going from a high pressure overloaded right ventricle to a pressure and volume overloaded right ventricle. You can tell the difference on an echo if you look at the right ventricle. The septum will bulge into the left ventricle in systole in pressure overload. It'll bulge into the left ventricle in diastole in volume overload. And if you get that D sign where it just doesn't move, that's pressure and volume overloaded. So let's say somebody has a big PE or an RV infarct. What happens is the right ventricle goes from a low pressure, high compliance system to now a pressure chamber, a higher pressure chamber. So your CVP will be higher. And normally CVP isn't really that consequential, but when the RV becomes a pressurized chamber, then it becomes a bigger deal. So if you have somebody who has a PE or an RV infarct and the CVP is 5 or 10, they could probably handle a little bit of fluid, gentle boluses, unless they get worse when you give them that fluid. If their CVP is 15 or 20, they can't handle fluid, and if you give them fluid, you're just going to decompensate them further. So the way to handle RV failure is to decrease the afterload of the RV. So with pulmonary vasodilators, inhaled nitric oxide, oxygen, things like that. And you can use an inotrope to the right ventricle. So if you use epinephrine, that has some inotropic effect. If you use low dose dopamine, that preferentially acts on the right ventricle. Or you can use just levofed or dobutamine. And if you use low doses, it will act preferentially on the right ventricle. Now keep in mind that the only thing that really allows the heart to maintain cardiac output in a pressure overloaded right ventricle is tachycardia. So although a heart rate of 180 is bad, a heart rate of 105 to 120 is probably the only thing that's going to maintain their systemic perfusion. Left heart failure, you have to decide, is this diastolic heart failure or systolic heart failure? And diastolic heart failure is really from longstanding hypertension, and the older the patient is, the more likely they are to have diastolic heart failure. And what you really want to do is diurese those patients. Systolic heart failure, you want to afterload those patients so that their left ventricle, that's now weak and stretched, can then overcome the afterload, which is going to be basically your mean arterial pressure. So you want to afterload those patients with arterial vasodilators and get things flowing forward. The extreme situation of left heart failure would be like valvular disease or valvular rupture, where there's really no pressure gradient created by the valves opening and closing. In that case, what you really want to do is aggressively afterload reduce so that you get forward flow instead of backward flow. And those are really surgical emergencies, but in the meantime, you have to use nitro peroxide, nicardipine, hydralazine and nitro, things like that, to try to get the arterial system vasodilated enough to when the ventricle contracts, it goes out the outflow tract and not backwards through the mitral valve and into the pulmonary circulation, giving you pulmonary edema. And we've already talked about thrombolytics for PE, so I won't discuss that. If anybody has any more questions about the types of heart failure or wants to go over it again, we can always meet and discuss it. But the lecture will ultimately be up on that website that we discussed earlier.
Very nice, Moj. So the big points to take away, is it right? Is it left? If it's right, why is the patient having right heart failure? Is this a big PE or is this an infarct? And then the important things to try to help augment your flow on the side that's not working well. Pressors, vasodilators, ionotropes, whatever you need to do to get blood going where it should be going. Sweet, we're almost done. All right, so the last thing that we were going to cover was low-risk chest pain. I have heard so many different things about low-risk chest pain and how it should be managed, and it seems like anywhere you go, they manage it a little bit differently. So I thought we'd take the same patient and ask several of our attendings that have worked in different institutions, that have had varying years of experience, that have had varying systems experience, and see what they would do with the following patient. A 52-year-old female comes in complaining of 10 minutes of right-sided chest pain, which she describes as dull and associated with tingling of her right arm. She has a history of hypertension that she's not taking medications for. She denies diabetes. She's not sure what her cholesterol is. She occasionally smokes, and there's no family history of early MI. Her pain and tingling have now completely resolved, and her vital signs are normal. In some way, shape, or form, this patient comes into the ED several times a day. So let's see what Isaac Farrell would do with a patient such as this.
Okay.
Surprisingly, the answer is not to kick her to the curb. So Isaac and I just went over the case, and I'm going to ask Isaac, what would your workup be for this lady?
Oh, Lordy. So chest pain. I gotta admit, first time you told me you're gonna do low risk chest pain, I had a little bit of a palpitation. This is like one of the most error prone and annoying patient populations we can take care of on a general basis. It's also one of the most popular. Yeah, when you're a resident, you're trying to figure out how you're going to deal with these patients when you got in the real world, and you get 10 different attendings with 10 different answers, and they all swear that their answer is the right answer and the way that you always have to manage these patients. I found that a lot of it's more of an art form, especially with this particular complaint. This chest pain patient's on the surface would appear to be low risk. She's 52. She's not postmenopausal, we're assuming, although I didn't get that from the history. She may have a couple traditional cardiac risk factors, such as she's got hypertension. She's may or may not have family history. She's an occasional history. She reports no family history, but may or may not have some distant family history. Couple things I do right off the bat when I get a chest pain patient. First thing is her vital signs. Vital signs are vital for a reason. I'm assuming all of her vital signs are stable. She's not tachypneic, hypotensive, anything like that. The next thing that I look at in conjunction with looking at the patient, is their EKG. Their EKG is going to give you some really important information right off the bat. Your EKG may tell you right off the bat that this is a high-risk patient, and you don't need to put that much more thought into it. The patient's having a STEMI. Call the clot team, have the cardiologist come in and do their magic. If you see the patient has some sort of arrhythmia in the setting of chest pain, I'm going to be a little bit more concerned and probably going to keep that patient in the hospital. And I don't really have to put a whole lot more thought into it other than ICU versus tele. If the patient's hypotensive or is in failure when I first walk into the room, I'm also not going to have to put a whole lot more thought into it because the patient is clearly in cardiogenic shock and is not a patient that I'm going to be observing and sending home. It's going to be a patient that's going to get further workup in the CCU. So assuming all those things are not present, then the first thing I'm looking on the EKG is for signs that there's ischemia, or you know, flip Ts, ST depressions, and even some signs that there may be some old disease, some Q waves. Those are going to help paint the picture of the story that the patient's going to tell me a moment later. And then I'm going to talk to the patient. I'm going to ask him a little bit more about their chest pain. This particular patient's describing as right-sided and dull, which is what I would typically label as non-anginal chest pain. Typically, I think of anginal chest pain as something that's substernal with a pressure-like sensation that's described by the patient, not necessarily pain, but has some pressure-like component to it. The second component in anginal chest pain that I look for, there being three, is that the pain is worsened by exertion or stress. And the third component was that it was relieved by rest or nitroglycerin. It doesn't sound like the last two components are met, and the first component is kind of shaky. So somebody that has two out of three, I typically call atypical angina, and has all three, I call angina. If they have one or none, I call that non-anginal chest pain. The reason being more important in a second when I talk about risk. After that, I follow up by getting the rest of the patient's history. It is entirely plausible with these patients that despite all your best risk stratification and all your recent reading up on cardiac chest pain, that it in fact may not be cardiac. So you need to be looking for other things and making sure you get the whole history to ensure that you're not chasing down a tunnel that ends in a dead end. You know, assuming I've done all that, I've asked all the appropriate questions, review of systems, et cetera, et cetera. The next thing I'm going to look at is ways that we can categorize the risk. There are multiple risk algorithms. I alluded to one of the earlier ones, the Goldman algorithm, when I started talking about the EKG. Essentially, I combine a couple of them. I think that's the safest way to do it. Goldman tends to ask things about physical findings, such as rouse on exam or a borderline hypotensive blood pressure as signs of risk, whereas Timmy tends to ask more about things that are historical. The way I look at this section of the chest pain evaluation is kind of like you're a card player sitting down for a game of poker. You're going to have to ascertain the risk based on all these different pieces of information that you're getting, the patient's history, the patient's physical findings, the EKG, and then to some extent just the spidey sense you get from looking at the patient. Is the patient diaphoretic? Are they pale? Do they have other signs that there may be something organic going on that's going to make you more concerned? At this point, I just start tabulating risk. We can quote percentages, you know, based on TEMI, but I find that to not be quite as helpful. When you look at multiple studies, those percentages vary based on the patient population. It ends up breaking out that anybody more than a TIMI 2 or greater is generally thought of as moderate risk, and less than that is low, moderate, or low risk. Like I said, the percentages are not absolute. So I'll assign risk based on the patient's vital signs. This patient's not hypotensive, no signs of failure, and we'll assume has a non-ischemic EKG at the moment. So when you look at this patient's 72-hour mortality under the Goldman rules, she's has no history of coronary artery disease, she's not describing crescendo angina, and has a non-ischemic EKG, so she would actually be very low risk. Looking at this from a TIMI standpoint, her age doesn't break 60. Both Goldman and TIMI look at age. Timmy's greater than 65, Goldman's greater than 60. I think the take-home message here is that age is probably one of your biggest predictors. The only thing that's a better predictor of risk is a history of coronary artery disease. Somebody that's had a previous MI is going to have more MIs, is the short of it. And this patient has neither one of those. Her risk, although she's aging, she's not pre-med or post-menopausal, so estrogen is still somewhat protective. Among Temi, she doesn't get three or more traditional cardiac risk factors. Maybe she's a little bit of a smoker, hypertension. We'll even get the benefit of the doubt, maybe she has a little bit of family, or maybe she has a bad cholesterol, which would give her three and give her 1 point under Timmy. That being said, she doesn't have a crescendo angina, she doesn't have an ischemic EKG, she doesn't have age, she doesn't have any other risk factors that we worry about with Timmy. So even under a Timmy scoring system, she's still going to be low risk. All of this being said, Gusto proved, if nothing else, that people with no risk factors do have MIs, up to 10% of them, in fact, in that study. What this amounts to is that spidey sense, that gut feeling you get. You can't perfectly assess risk in every patient. Risk stratification can't tell you who can go home or who can stay. The best it can tell you is how hard you have to look. If your gut is telling you to look harder, there may be things that you're not attuned to in your risk stratification, such as diaphoresis, a pale patient, or a patient that just doesn't seem right. There's always place for listening to your clinical acumen. That's why we aren't robots practicing medicine. We're physicians practicing the art of medicine. I think in this particular patient, if I found nothing alarming after meeting the lady and talking to her, and I felt that she had good follow-up, that she could be seen within 24 hours, I might look at that as one option. Observe her in the emergency department with serial enzymes and EKGs, giving a little bit of tincture at a time for badness to show itself, and then refer the next day to see her doctor, along with discharge instructions for herself and her doctor about what I was concerned about, leaving the role of setting up a stress test to her physician. The alternative, if I'm not certain about the patient's follow-up with their primary doctor, but I'm certain that the patient would follow up with me if I gave them the instructions, or would follow up with instructions I gave them, I might set up a stress test for the following day, followed by a cardiology appointment. All that being said, nothing else works out and the patient does not seem socially to be able to follow up, at that point then I start looking to play a little magic and see what I can potentially get done in the emergency department before the patient leaves, at least to minimize risk. There's multiple imaging modalities, stress modalities available. Probably the most likely to be available in the ED is one of two, either echo or CTA. Even a resting echo, while not sensitive, it is fairly specific for identifying patients that are at risk. So, to go in and do a bedside echo and see how her heart is contracting may be enough to push me one way or the other. If you see somebody that has a poor contraction on echo, that's actually fairly predictive of a patient that has a high likelihood of having a cardiac event in the next 30 days. If I'm more interested in a more sensitive means of assessing the patient, and I don't feel that their calcium level is going to be much of a factor, then CTA is another option. Obviously, in patients with arrhythmias or renal insufficiency, or a history of lots of coronary calcifications, this test is going to be a little bit more difficult to obtain. Other tests in these are probably more well-suited for the inpatient stay. But these are two that in some instances you may even in the private setting have available to you to order. And certainly in some academic institutions we have these available. I think that summarizes how I would look at this patient. More than likely, if the patient was a reasonable follow-up, it'd be a short observation period with a follow-up with a regular doctor within 24 hours.
That was a wonderful review of chest pain and all of our risk stratification that we're taught. Isaac does a great job of doing that, which is why I wanted to have him lead this off first. So there's one opinion from Isaac Farrell, what he would do with this patient. He would classify her as low-risk chest pain, and he'd like to work her up, make sure that she's not hiding something serious. And if everything comes back normal, This would be the patient that he would try to risk stratify further with provocative testing as an outpatient, assuming she can get it. So let's ask Noah Tolby, who's one of our new attendings that's actually been an attending for a long time out in the community, and we'll get his opinion from a different perspective. All right, so we're talking with Noah Tolby now, and we've reviewed the same case. So Noah, just to give us a little bit of a heads up, how long have you been in practice, and where have you practiced before you came here?
So I've been in practice for 10 years. I graduated residency in 2003 here from U of A, and I've been in a community-based ED practice for the last 10 years at St. Joe's and St. Mary's, and saw about 110,000 patients a year.
What's kind of the patient population you're seeing at St. Joe's versus St. Mary's?
Joe's is a mix, but predominantly elderly patients. We'll see a lot of nursing home patients. And then St. Mary's is a little bit more of a mix, but we also had some elderly population too.
I got to tell you a story of, I was actually a medical student at Joe's, and I was working with one of the other docs, and you said, "Hey, medical student, you want to come see a paracentesis?" And I said, "Yeah, I'd love to." So I went in, we did the paracentesis. You go, "Okay, just hold the needle here, just for a little bit." About 2 hours later, I'm still holding the needle. You go, "Are you still in here?"
Aaron, I remember that. I remember that because I tell that story, and until this moment, I forgot that it was you.
That's awesome.
Yeah, and I remember coming back, I said, "Oh, I felt horrible."
Oh, it was great, man. It was a good learning experience. Oh, it was awesome. Now I do that to all my medical students. Oh, man. What's your workup going to be for this patient based on your old practice setting, not here? Or let us know if it's changed at all since you've been here.
Right. So you're painting a picture of a relatively low-risk chest pain patient, relatively low TIMI score, although I do have some concern that this patient may have some underlying coronary artery disease, and we have some risk factors, the tobacco. You know, she's not 65, she's in her 50s, so I'm concerned, and we don't know what her cholesterol status is. But I think this is a low enough risk patient where if she's pain-free in the ED, at a minimum, I would do at least 2 EKGs. And I would do troponin, and I'm a big believer in a low-risk patient doing the delta troponin, so even 2 hours apart. In reality, that's probably a 3 to 4 hour just based on the efficiency of the ED. If those are normal, like so negative tropes, at the very least a non-specific EKG or normal EKG, you've essentially made them very low risk, at least safe for going home. We had a good system at St. Joe's and St. Mary's where the cardiologists were on board. These are the kind of patients they can see within 48 to 72 hours for reassessment. Whether they're getting provocative stress testing is not really clear, but I feel comfortable if they at least see a cardiologist in a short period of time, they can go home.
You have to have a pretty good relationship, I'm assuming, with your cardiologist at your institution to be able to set up something like that. Is that fair to say?
Yes, you do. It's really important. For example, one of the new cardiologists that came on with the group at St. Joe's, I would call him, and he was different. He said, "I don't feel confident that I can see this patient within a week. I'd like you to admit the patient for observation." And so that was a bit of a surprise on that one. But in general, you should have a good understanding with your cardiologist what they'd like to do.
Yeah, so very institution-based. Even though we've got all these national guidelines, we've got all the stuff that you're kind of see through residency, depending on where you go, it seems to be very institutional-based on who's safe to go home and who's not. Would you agree?
I would agree.
Okay, interesting.
I think my opinion is that we're overdoing it with admitting patients with the misconception that it'll be safer for the patient to stay overnight as opposed to going home. And there's really, to this date, and you can probably back this up, there's really no great data that suggests that keeping them, and we're talking about a low-risk patient, keeping them in the hospital is safer than going home.
Mm-hmm. So aside from all the other risk factors, is there anybody, the ones that we always know about, is there anybody you would consider to be somebody that's outside of the norm, they're not 65, smoker, hyperlipidemia, all the other classic ones, that just makes you say, "Man, that's a really good story for ACS. I don't know if I can call you low risk. You may not have all the traditional factors, but something about it just makes me nervous about you."
Right. Well, as well as I do, the most important thing with chest pain evaluation is a history and your suspicion that they have ACS. All the risk factors, you can just throw them out the door. So if I'm concerned about this story, I'm working them up, and they're no longer low risk to me. Now, maybe if they're 20 years old and with a stone cold normal EKG and they're pain free when I'm done, maybe I'll send them home with good follow up. But an older patient in their 50s with a good story, I'm concerned.
Is there anybody that you feel, after you've done their EKG, their two troponins, you say, you know, you come to the ED all the time. You're always here for some kind of chest pain. I don't care whether or not you get the provocative testing. You're fine. You're here all the time. You don't need the provocative testing. Is there anyone that you're willing to kind of put yourself out there for? Because that's essentially what we're doing when we say that.
You know, if I find somebody routinely using the ED, I have a conversation with the cardiologist and I say, these are the facts. This is what I'm seeing now. What do you recommend? Because, you know, I feel like my responsibility is for the patient in the ED, and the long-term responsibility is really going to be follow up with the cardiologist. So I will engage them. I won't just keep, you know, sending them out without having a discussion with somebody.
So some nice words from Noah, who has some good experience out in the private sector of being able to contact the patient's cardiologist, trying to get them follow up, and again, working through your system. And I found more and more as I'm attending that as some of my friends that were in residency with me have established private practices around town, I call them, I talk to them, I said, hey, did you really tell your kid to come in here and get a head CT? And they go, nah. No, it's probably the nurse at the front desk. The more you're able to talk to the providers, you're able to say, oh, yeah, no, that kid should come in tomorrow. Here's an appointment. We got it all squared away. Really helps your management. Kind of tough in an academic center, but as you get out into your own practice and you start to learn the people, start to learn the players, start to learn the patients, it can be really helpful for you. So we're going to talk with Art Sanders now, get his opinion about the same patient and kind of see what he would do. So, Art, you got this lady who comes in, her chest pain's now resolved. What kind of things are you looking for in her physical exam or other kind of tests that are going to help you determine whether or not she's low risk?
The physical exam usually doesn't help that much. People say if you listen every hour to someone having an acute MI, you might hear a rub, you might hear an S4. But that's really difficult to base it on the physical exam. What you can hear is something to indicate a lung etiology. You could find right up a quadrant tenderness. You could the issue of being tender to touch is listed on some of the criteria. I think some of the AHA classification criteria. But I don't find it terribly useful unless the patient is obvious that that's what it is and there's a setting of a pulled muscle or trauma. A minority of patients, but still a considerable minority of patients with acute coronary syndromes have reproducible chest pain. This is obviously a middle-aged female, so she can have atypical symptoms. The case here does seem atypical chest pain, and the fact that her pain went away is important for later management.
I think most people would write the orders before they even saw the patient, and her first troponin comes back negative. Is this someone that you would try to do a provocative testing or any kind of risk stratification testing in the ED to get this patient home? Or is this someone that you think probably should be admitted and, you know, won't be able to, you know, we don't want to take the risk? Or is this someone you'd even feel comfortable if the second troponin is negative to send her out for a 72-hour follow-up?
Yeah, a lot of the answer to that depends on the system that you're working in. And I think you just have to know what the system is and work within that. Some places have chest pain units. Some places have rapid exercise stress tests. There are a variety of the next step provocative tests. In this system where we can admit them for a more rapid provocative test, but we can also get usually a 72-hour or within 72-hour a cardiology evaluation and usually a provocative test, I would probably get the second troponin and a second EKG. And if that's negative and there's no other obvious cause of her pneumonia or obvious GI cause, I would arrange for outpatient, usually stress testing or some provocative test.
Do you know where the 72 hours comes from of why we kind of use that as our yardstick for outpatient follow-up?
I think it comes from the American Heart Association, American College of Cardiology guidelines. Is it based on any good data? Probably not. It's probably a consensus that this is reasonable. You know, I've admitted patients to our clinical decision units. I remember one distinctly. It was an elderly man who I knew, and this was like a Friday evening, and he actually had a stent and was seeing a cardiologist, and this was somewhat atypical, but I felt I had to admit him for the chest pain. And he didn't get a stress test, or he didn't see a cardiologist until Monday. So he was sitting there bored in the hospital for 3 days, basically, you know, exposed to MRSA and developing DVTs and all these other bad things in the hospital. Because even as an inpatient, you don't necessarily get the rapid workup.
Kind of all the risks, none of the benefit.
Yeah.
It's unfortunate.
So obviously it depends on the system, and part of our obligation is to work the system to get rapid workup. Optimally, we'd be able to get a rapid test from the emergency department, but I don't think there's many that can do this.
Now, is there anything that she could have told you in her history regarding a recent provocative test that would make you think, okay, two troponins and we'll let you go home? If she said, I've had a cath within the last X amount of months, I've had a stress test that was negative, I've had a CTA of my coronaries that was negative, any of these that would make you say, okay, we don't need to do any more provocative testing because you were appropriately screened X time ago, or do you treat everyone as a fresh start when they come in with chest pain?
I think if she had a clean cath within the past 5 years, certainly within the past year or two, that would make me think there's other reasons for the chest pain that has to be worked up, usually by the primary care provider. The other tests are less certain. One of the common, I think, misconceptions is doing some of the tests, like the CT angios, where we're looking, or calcium scores, and we're looking for obstruction in the coronary arteries. And the distinction has to be made, is the chest pain due to the obstruction in the coronary arteries or not? So if you take a group of Americans who are 52 years old, you'll find a fair number, and you did coronary angios on these people, you'll find a fair number of them have arteriosclerosis. And what do you do about it? And there really hasn't been good evidence that improving blood flow extends their life. The only evidence is for a STEMI, improving it immediately, or for someone with intractable anginal pain. So I think we kind of fall into the trap as to what's the anatomy versus what's the cause of their pain. And so sometimes they overlap, and sometimes people who are not having cardiac pain get cath, get workup, get stented or bypassed, and it's really not the cause of their pain. I think we're really good at diagnosing STEMIs. We're really good at diagnosing non-STEMI MIs by the two troponins. What we're not good at is saying, is this new onset angina a cardiac pain, or is this non-cardiac pain? So someone will become wealthy and famous if they develop a good test to say whether this is not cardiac pain or this is actually cardiac pain.
Very cool. Scholar Quest project for anybody that's interested in doing that one. Do you have any other kind of last words about a patient like this, or about these, you know, how to determine someone's low risk chest pain or not?
I'm not too enthusiastic about, there's a TIMI score, there's I think it's GUESS score, there's some other scores, but most of them involve, for example, the TIMI score, at least what I'm familiar with, is basically says the patient is having either an NSTEMI or unstable angina. So it really doesn't include the non-cardiac chest pain. And you're basically taking factors of saying what are factors which make it more probable that this patient has coronary artery disease, which is a different question than what's this chest pain due to. And so the focus, at least in the emergency department, should be what's this chest pain due to.
All right. Thank you very much. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
So once again, we have the systems point brought up that you need to know the system you're operating in. And I think Art brings up a really good point of it's easy to think that every low-risk chest pain that comes in is just a cardiac cause we need to rule out. But often we need to be looking for other sources of pain, or else that person keeps coming back, my chest pain, my chest pain, my chest pain, until we finally cath them and seen every capillary and find out, oh, you have a rib fracture. Did you know that? So to round things out, we're going to end up with Scott Lowery, one of my favorite people to have on here, because his opinion is always poignant. And now, Scott, how many years have you been practicing outside of residency?
5 years.
And during that time, which places, I feel like I'm giving you a deposition, during that time, which places did you practice at? What kind of an environment?
I was at TMC for 4 years, which is a full tertiary center. We have every specialty on call. And then I went to St. Joe's and St. Mary's for a year, which pretty much is the same. They alternate a couple different specialties, but in general, they have everything on hand.
Cool. Now, let's say that you were back there. What did you do with this patient when they would come in? What would your workup be? And what do you kind of assume your ultimate disposition would be for this lady?
So this is pretty much a slam dunk for every hospital in town, and every hospitalist will say thank you for your business when you admit this chest pain rule out. This is an easy patient, assuming nothing catastrophic happens while she's on your watch. It's a troponin EKG, normal labs, and you're admitting as soon as the first troponin comes back. Just so you know, they're not going to a STEMI lab for an NSTEMI, cath lab for an NSTEMI. So first troponin come back negative, you admit the patient, and have a nice day.
We hear sometimes the residents, and I was one of these residents that would often say, like, man, I feel like I have absolutely punished the medical service tonight. And what you're telling me is once they actually start getting paid for the job that they're doing, that it's not such a big deal?
Right. So every admission you give them is money in their pocket. You're giving them business. And a chest pain rule out is easy business. It's one of their favorites. It's their easiest admission. It's the best for your liability. It's pretty much a win-win, and nobody complains about those patients.
Is there anything that would have changed this lady's story to make you say, actually, I think you can go home? If we get two troponins, two normal EKGs, I think you can go home after this.
So the patient was admitted a week ago or a month ago with the same complaint, had a workup, had a normal stress or a normal cath. I call their cardiologist because their cardiologist wants to know about every one of these patients and say, Mrs. Jones presents to the ED again with her chest pain. First trope's negative. EKG is unchanged from prior. Do you have any suggestions, or can I get follow-up with you in your office? And almost every time they'll say, absolutely. I just cathed her a week ago. It was clean or no change from prior. I'll see her in my office tomorrow.
What kind of patients would you consider to be so low risk they don't even warrant troponins? They don't even warrant the cardiac workup. They're just fine. They just need to, you know, I think your chest pain's fine. You can just go home.
Young panic attack comes in all the time for the same thing. We had one at Keno yesterday that I was like, really, we don't probably need to do this cardiac workup on. Pain resolved when she calmed down, hyperventilated. She's been here 7 times in the last 2 months for the same thing. I don't necessarily think you need a workup on them every time.
It seems like with chest pain, when I was in like my junior year, I started feeling more and more like, man, none of these ever turn out to be anything. I'm just sick and tired of these chest pains. It's just so monotonous, so rote. This is not challenging me as a doctor. I just feel like I'm a part of the machine that's pushing these patients through. But when you're out on your own, how does that change for you?
So I actually had a conversation like this with a hospitalist at TMC, first couple of months out of residency, and I was thinking the same thing. You know, I would work this person up and get him out of here and not admit him. And the hospitalist told me, why would you take that upon yourself and on your own liability? If you see 100 chest pains in over how much time, you see so many in a day, you work in an 8-hour shift, you probably see at least 2-3 chest pains each shift, and you're working 4 shifts a week, you're talking 12 plus chest pains a week. So in less than a month and a half, or I'm sorry, 2 months, you're over 100 patients of chest pain. And if you're missing 1%, that's one patient that you let an MI go, 1% seems like a low risk. But if you're letting that go through and you're discharging those and letting them go home, you just sent home an MI every 2 months. So he said, just admit them. He got burned on one that he came down and consulted for and said, yeah, it's probably a low risk. Let's get them go home. They went home and came back with an MI. The only addition to that is throughput. You're increasing the throughput for your department by getting them out of the department. Now, this obviously does not count in our situation now where you admit them and then 12 hours later they get a bed. But in the, whatever he likes to call the real world, you admit them and put in their holding orders and they're supposed to be gone within 30 to 60 minutes.
I think what I took away from this is that there's a whole lot of art to medicine. You can know the science, but there's a lot of art to it, and not just Art Sanders.
Yeah, I agree. The message I took away that each of the four people had very logical approaches to the way they handle the low-risk chest pain, but the one thing that each of them had was consistency. So I think there's multiple ways to skin this cat. No matter how you choose to do that, as long as you're consistent, you can protect yourself.
I think one thing that Art and I were talking about afterwards that I wanted to add in into this is, what do I do as the resident? When I'm the resident and I present one attending with this patient and they tell me, oh, no, you got to do this. You always do this. And then that attending goes off shift and I present a very similar patient to a different attending and they say, why would you do that? No, you should always do this. What do I do as a resident? What do I just get frustrated? Do I just complain? Or what do I do?
Well, I think that, and we were both residents here, we had to deal with that situation. I think that you just take that, put it in the back of your mind of how it's going to mold you and how you practice later.
This is a good learning opportunity. Instead of getting diagnostic whiplash back and forth of somebody who's really conservative versus someone who's really liberal, take the opportunity to just pretend, okay, well, I'm learning from this attending, so let me just spend this day thinking that everyone with chest pain is going to die if I send them home. And let's see what happens. Because really, it's ultimately up to that attending's discretion. And then when you work with an attending that's super liberal, okay, fine. No one that comes in with chest pain is going to die unless they're showing a STEMI right in front of me. I remember listening to EM Rap, and I heard within 2 months of each other, Corey Slovis say, the only low-risk chest pain is if they can show me the knuckle marks on their chest where they were punched. And then I heard Scott Weingard say, who cares if we miss an MI? The only proven intervention is for STEMI. So if we miss an NSTEMI or an unstable angina, who cares? Those are wildly different opinions from people who are widely publicized. So I think it just goes to show that there's a lot of art to this, and you got to figure out, everybody mentioned, you got to figure out what the system you're working in does with these patients.
Yeah, one thing I guess I would say to that is that as a society, we've determined that we can't miss more than 2% of MIs. So when you think about the pathophysiology of how MI happens, I mean, it's really visceral pain. And what do you do about visceral pain type symptoms? And what do you do about the patient who's got diabetes and doesn't just have somatosensory neuropathy, but they've got visceral neuropathy? At what point do you say, I can't really trust that their chest pain isn't cardiac? It's all a matter of risk and what risk you're willing to take. I think Scott said something that kind of struck me, and I try to think about this every once in a while, and that if we're not going to miss more than 2% of MIs, that's a whole lot of patients that we have to admit that have nothing. Noper was telling me one time when he was a resident that they were expected to admit at least 4 patients who had nothing for every 1 patient that had unstable angina or an MI. And now I think those numbers have gotten bigger. But it was just expected that's what you did. But if you think about it, 6 out of every 10 patients that come to the emergency department come for a cardiac cause. And if the average emergency physician sees 5,000 patients a year, that's a significant number of cardiac patients. You obviously can't admit every one of those, but you really can't send every one of them home or you're going to miss something. So for me, I think it's challenging. And Racy and I used to discuss this when he worked at Northwest. All of his patients had follow-up the next day. He would get one troponin, send them home, and have them see the cardiologist the next day. Our patient population all has diabetes, hypercholesterolemia, hypertension, and can't get follow-up. So you have to take that into consideration as well. What do you think? Yeah.
No, I think that's what it boils down to, is wherever you work, you got to figure out, where's my patient going to go? Because we can rule someone out for an MI to like 97% sensitivity with two tropes and two EKGs and a good history and physical. So if that's the case, then it's that other 1%, if we allow a 2% miss rate, or really if you're a lawyer, you have a 0% miss rate for an MI. We never can miss an MI. You know, if that's what we're trying to find, then we got to figure out our risk stratification. And if any of you guys have not seen on Panopto, Chris Williams' risk stratification lecture, it was really, really good. It just gives you an idea of what we do with these patients that have chest pain, or what we do with these patients that have abdominal pain. Just that we are risk stratifiers. We have to know the risks. We have to know the benefits. We have to know that if we admit somebody that's super low risk and they end up having an abnormal stress for some fluke, and then they end up getting a cath and getting a pseudoaneurysm of their artery, or getting a pericardial tear or something bizarre like that, you know, these are other risks. Not everything we do is completely benign. So let's say that we do find something, but it's still kind of inconclusive. You got to keep going. You get this diagnostic momentum that can make you crazy too. So I think the best way to end this is that no one knows, and you develop your own style, you develop your own ability to sleep at night, and you have to know within your system not only what is the standard practice, but what is the best practice for your patient.
And be consistent.
Mm-hmm. Well, we're at the end of an hour, so I think we're just about done. We've covered quite a bit of stuff. We actually don't have time for billing. Oh, I know, you're all very disappointed. But the one thing I would like to push for is we have the Epic Go Live that starts in November, and as much as you may be frustrated with computers and the people who invented them, please make sure that you remember that we're still taking care of patients. And you can do that despite computers, despite the entire hospital being in flames if that happens, which it may. But just keep in mind that we can keep checking up on our patients, communicate with your nurses, talk to them face to face. And this is a time where we can actually do our best care, because we're kind of at a loss for what to do with this new system. So as you're learning the system, go talk to your patients, communicate with your patients, talk to your nurses, and we'll make this go as smoothly as possible. And I think that wraps up most of our questions, except for one. What does the fuck say?